Welcome to Behind the Headlines, a weekly recap of Utah news by the Salt Lake Tribune. This week on the program, indicted businessman Jeremy Johnson says he gave money to people who in turn contributed to Senator Mike Lee's campaign, all at the instruction of former Utah Attorney General John Swallow. Meanwhile, state and federal officers execute a search warrant at the homes of Swallow, former AG Mark Shurtleff, and a campaign worker. Shurtleff calls the search outrageous. He also said he expects to be charged and acquitted. So what will happen next? And the ACLU says complaining to the Days of 47 parade about who can march and who can't could violate the First Amendment. Will the Salt Lake City Council back off? All that and Salt Lake Tribune columnist Robert Kirby. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce. Stay tuned for Behind the Headlines after the news. Welcome to Behind the Headlines. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce with the Salt Lake Tribune. And today on the program, we have straw donors, police raids, parade meddling, and much more. And joining me this morning to talk about the week's news, Tribune government reporter Robert Gerke. Robert, welcome back.
Thanks. Good morning.
Also with us, editorial writer George Pyle. George, thanks for being here.
Good morning.
And columnist Paul Raleigh. Hi there, Paul.
Good morning.
And you can join us as well. What headlines have you been scratching your head about this week? You can send your questions and comments to the hashtag TribTalk on Twitter and Google+. You can put them in the comments section at sltrib.com. You can also call us, and that number is 801-355-TALK, 801-355-8255. Robert, I'm going to start with you. Lots of news on your beat this week. More allegations from Jeremy Johnson. He's, of course, the businessman who's facing some fraud charges. What's the latest development?
Well, this had been kind of rumored for several months, but in an affidavit that was supporting a search warrant that was unsealed on Wednesday, there was buried on page 37, there was a passage about how Jeremy Johnson has apparently been cooperating with investigators, which in itself is kind of a revelation. But what he told them was that in 2010, when Senator Mike Lee was getting nearing a primary election in his bid for Senate, John Swallow asked him if he would contribute $50,000 through other individuals to Mike Lee's campaign, basically laundering the contributions through these other individuals to get around the federal cap of $2,500 per person per contribution.
So big no-no.
It's a big no-no, and it's something that, you know, if it's just done by accident or you know, isn't egregious, the Federal Election Commission can impose civil fines. If it's done intentionally, as it appears to have been done in this case, then the Department of Justice can prosecute people, and people have gone to jail for this. So that in itself was a pretty big revelation. The House committee, when they released their report back in March, hinted at that this might have happened because they had this email from Swallow to Johnson. Several of the checks bounced because the people or the campaign deposited the checks before the individuals who wrote the checks were able to deposit Jeremy's money in the bank. So several of the checks bounced, and that was sort of a head scratcher, I guess, at the time. We didn't know the checks bounced because Jeremy's money hadn't been deposited yet, but there was some suggestion that had happened. So anyway, so on Wednesday this comes out, and it's kind of a big deal. The the Alliance for a Better Utah says they're going to file a complaint with the Federal Election Commission. And Johnson also said he did the same thing for Mark Shurtleff when Mark Shurtleff was looking at running for the Senate in 2009. After Shurtleff decided not to run, that's when Mike Lee got in. But Jeremy actually told investigators, according to the affidavit, that he had given Shurtleff about $113,000 in straw donations for his 2009, in preparation for his 2009 bid that didn't happen. So that's a pretty serious revelation. Also, the contributions to Shurtleff were also in at the direction of John Swallow, according to what Jeremy told investigators.
Okay, so no one is admitting that they knew anything about this. Let's start with Swallow first. His attorney says basically this is a case of CYA, yeah. You know, that Johnson is saying anything to shift responsibility from his case to John Swallow.
Right, right. Jeremy's facing scores of criminal charges in the federal level and also has a civil lawsuit against him for fraudulent business practices. So according to Swallow's attorney, Rod Snow, he says that Jeremy is doing whatever he can to save his own skin. And that includes making things up, you know, making up allegations against the former attorney general and the sitting junior senator. John Swallow has, or I mean, Mark Shurtleff has said that he had no idea if this happened or that it happened. The Mike Lee campaign says that the senator and neither the senator nor anybody on the campaign had any indication this happened. One of the election law experts I talked to, Matt Sanderson, who works does campaign law back in D.C., said it's pretty unusual that the Federal Election Commission or the Department of Justice will go after the campaigns for this practice unless it's clear that they knew about it. Typically, when they've filed these charges, they've just gone after the individuals who sort of perpetrated the act, the straw donors and the people who provided the money. So yeah, I mean but it does open up a new chapter. It draws draws Mike Lee into the fray a little bit, and creates a possibility for the federal investigators to get involved again. I mean, this would have to be a case. If they were to prosecute this criminally, it would have to be something done at the federal level. It's not a state crime.
So if they didn't know, if Senator Lee, if Mark Shurtleff, if they did not know, they could not be penalized. Is that what your expert was saying?
That's what he's saying. Unless it's clear that the campaign knew or I guess perhaps should have known that this was happening, you know, then they typically won't be charged or penalized civilly by the campaign. It's kind of interesting though, because John Swallow's had some encounters with the Federal Election Commission before, in 2002 and in 2004 when he was running for Congress. In both races, he was fined by the FEC for violating campaign law. In one instance, it was because he was taking contributions that went beyond the campaign limits and sort of reallocating them to other individuals, which I think, when all was said and done, he paid about $35,000 in fines for the individuals, and the campaign paid $35,000 in fines for those violations.
What do we know about these straw donors, these people who were allegedly putting up money that wasn't theirs, but putting it in their name and contributing to a campaign? And what happens to them? Are these people that we've heard of before? Who are they?
Well, the ones that we are fairly sure we know are individuals who were identified in the House investigative report. One of them is a gentleman named Arvin Black, who's from Southern Utah, who last year was charged with running a Ponzi scheme, and last month actually was sentenced to I believe it was 63 months in prison, in federal prison, for this Ponzi scheme he was running. Two others were his family members. I believe it was his wife and son, if I remember right. And so those are the ones we know. There are obviously, if there's $50,000 at play here, there are some that we haven't been able to identify yet. So we've been looking through, you know, Mike Lee's campaign contribution reports. All of these contributions, interestingly, came right on the cusp of the primary election. You remember in 2010, Mike Lee was in a primary race with Tim Bridgewater. The money, you know, the fundraising for that was pretty crucial. And so this money came in at a pretty important time and, you know, sort of manna from heaven, I guess, when you get that kind of money falling in your lap.
This raises so many interesting questions. So I'll ask our editorial commentators. George, is Jeremy Johnson a reliable witness? That's a question.
Well, that's going to be a huge question for the prosecutors in this, because it's obvious that he's in trouble, that he's got a lot of charges, criminal and civil, filed against him. And one of the best things you can do if you're in a situation like this is promise the prosecutors, you know, there's always a bigger fish. And it's this way in the drug world, it's this way in white collar crime all over, it's this way on Wall Street. The best thing you can do is cop yourself a plea and get a reduced or even no jail is to say, well, I'm just a little guy in this. Here's the big fish over here. You ought to go arrest him. Mm. And sometimes they're not telling the truth. But the reason that Swallow and Shurtleff are vulnerable to these charges, the reason that we don't just laugh this off and say, oh, these guys are just trying to save their own skins, is because it's well known that they were associated. It's well known that they were going together and raising money and spending time at Tony Golf Resorts and doing all this kind of stuff. If these people didn't know each other, if these people hadn't made a lot of legal campaign contributions back and forth, then nobody would be buying any of this. But this this pool that these people have been swimming in together for so long makes these charges credible.
Mm. Raleigh, so just another piece of evidence in the case against John Swallow?
Yeah. I mean, the evidence is building up pretty rapidly. And, you know, we've all been hearing these rumors that charges are imminent, will be coming down soon against both Shurtleff and Swallow. You know, back to the Jeremy Johnson thing, I mean, you know, George makes a good point. But this guy really does have a big motive to lie. I mean, you know, to reduce whatever penalties he's going to end up with, and that sort of thing. And that's what I guess Swallow and Shurtleff and their attorneys are banking on, his credibility or lack thereof. But at the same time, I mean, Swallow and Shurtleff, before he got, all the problems with Jeremy Johnson became evident. I mean, they were in bed with the guy. You look at the people that they hung around with, and like George said, going down to these resorts on the dime of people who their office or Shurtleff's office at the time was negotiating a plea deal with, you know. And the whole thing stinks, and it's getting stinkier all the time. And
but that's why they are going to have something other than Johnson's word. And that's why they're serving all these subpoenas and serving all these warrants and carting off hard drives and computers and things like that. They need a paper trail to make these charges stick, because just Johnson's word is not credible all by itself.
Gerke, and Johnson's trial is approaching.
His criminal trial?
Yes.
Tom Harvey's been covering that more than I have. I know they've been trying to push for a date. Johnson wants this thing expedited because he doesn't think the federal government has the goods on him, so he's been trying to move it along.
Well, as you alluded to, George, this is not the only development in the whole Swallow-Shurtleff conundrum. Earlier this week, of course, federal and state officers executed a search warrant against Swallow, against Shurtleff, and interestingly, on one of their former campaign workers. Robert, give us the rundown. What happened on Monday?
Well, it was Monday evening. The agents served the warrant at the homes of John Swallow, Mark Shurtleff, as you mentioned, and the third individual was a young woman named Renee Cowley. She was a campaign staffer. She actually worked for Shurtleff in the Attorney General's office briefly, and then now she's a lobbyist up on the Hill. It's a little unclear at this point. The warrants themselves haven't been unsealed, so we don't know precisely what they were looking for or why they served them at the time that they did. According to what Mark Shurtleff has said, you know, and what Renee's attorney has said, they took computers, they took papers, they took phones and you know, digital devices and some you know, like I said, some other papers, some memory devices. So, you know, this is just sort of another step, I think, in the ongoing evolution of this. They'll probably now go search those, and like I said, we don't know what they were looking for. The contention, I guess, from former Attorney General Shurtleff is that they were overzealous, I guess, in their execution of these warrants, that they came in armed, they came in wearing body armor, they pointed guns at his children, they basically tossed the house, threw things on the floor and pulled drawers out and so forth.
And he's mad about it. He went on a media blitz this week and condemned how the police raid was conducted. Does his account jibe with what you're hearing? What happened at John Swallow's house? What happened at Renee Cowley's house? Did they get the full, you know, the guns, the full body armor treatment?
Well, it's a little unclear, to be honest. I mean, there were photographs taken at both houses, and we don't see the guns in the photographs, you know, but according to Attorney General Shurtleff, those photographs weren't taken inside the house at the time of the raid. They were taken after, as they were going through things. You know, it's a little unclear, I guess, whose version of events is accurate in this. It's noteworthy, I guess, that DPS didn't deny that they were armed, and that they didn't deny that they went in, you know, sort of, breaking down the door or whatnot. They just said that they followed proper procedure, that they used the minimum force necessary for this sort of thing, and that everybody was compliant and there were no incidents. And so that's sort of not a that's not a denial of the aversion that Shurtleff tells. So, I guess fair to say we're still looking at into it to figure out whose version of events is accurate, and we'll try to find out, I guess.
In a Trib Talk conversation with the two of us on Wednesday, Robert, Shurtleff says that he does expect to be charged, but he insists that he will be acquitted, and he's always maintained his innocence.
I mean, he insists that these the sort of the narrative that's been created that in people's minds by the media and in, you know, by the investigators in these court records is a twisting of the facts, and when all of the facts are laid on the table, he's going to be exonerated. But at this point, you know, I think it's clear, as Paul alluded to, you know, he sees this as this investigation has been going on for so long. They've gathered so much evidence. They've put so much time and effort and money and manpower into it that at this point, walking away from it seems unlikely. So he does expect to be charged. I think maybe the search warrant that was served on Monday sort of solidified that sense in his mind. We don't know when that's going to be. Salt Lake County District Attorney Sim Gill has said it would be, he said about 3 months ago it would be 3 to 6 months. So we're in that window now. It could be any time. He's kind of suggesting it's going to be a few more weeks probably, you know, but likely by the end of by the middle of September would be in that 3 to 6 month, the end date, the furthest date out on the 3 to 6 month window. I should note too that that Gill does not say that they will be charged. He says they're going to bring it to a conclusion is the term he uses. So he's not tipping his hand in that regard yet.
Okay, well, lots to talk about here. George, I'll start with you. Is Shurtleff's account to be believed? If it is to be believed, was excessive force used? What's the protocol? What should be the protocol for white-collar criminals or suspects, I should say, as opposed to violent criminals? People you know have drugs, have gun stockpiles. I mean, do you approach those situations? Should you approach them in the same way?
Well, they say that they talked about we followed standard operating procedure. We are told that standard operating procedure does include body armor, no matter where you're going, because somebody might panic and shoot you. It does not include, we are told, actually leveling automatic weapons at teenagers with your laser sight fixed. This is not corroborated by any outside witnesses. It apparently did not happen at Swallow's house or the other house. With Shurtleff, who, you know, used to be, who was Attorney General for a long time, and in his interview with you the other day was saying that when I was Attorney General, we did training and we tried to impress upon people that this is not the way you enter a home, that you execute a search warrant, unless you have real, pretty concrete evidence that the person in there is hostile, is armed, is dangerous, is going to be desperate to destroy evidence, marijuana plants or something, which is what they're usually fishing for. But at the same time, I mean, I don't see, there's no way, to my understanding, that even if this happened the way Shurtleff is explaining it, that that would lead to any kind of suppression of evidence because there was a valid search warrant served. If he's trying to play for the court of public opinion, the overnights are bad. The letters we're getting, the comments on the stories is basically come down to, oh, poor baby. You know, you've been in charge of the Utah law enforcement system, which has been known to bust guns pointed into the wrong house, wrestle people to the floor and point a gun at them, and then later find out that you really meant to raid the house down the street. That raid in Ogden, where an officer was killed in a firefight that ensued from a raid looking for a guy with 12 marijuana plants. I mean, this is the militarization of the police that a lot of people are really objecting to, and this is an example. And it would sort of be too bad if the thing that made us stop and think about the way we execute these search warrants is that we happen to do one against a white guy with a lawyer, a rich white guy with a lawyer, a rich white guy who is a lawyer, a rich white guy who used to be the chief lawyer, and now all of a sudden we're worried about maybe we do this a little too rough. Well, if it's a way to stop and think and wonder about the way we do this, then that might be one bright light out of all this fog.
Paul Raleigh, it's interesting that Shurtleff was served a warrant Swallow was served a warrant. And then this person that we know very little about, she's a lobbyist, Renee Cowley. Mm-hmm. What does that say to you about this whole investigation?
Well, her lawyer acted surprised that her house was, they had a search warrant and raided her house because she's been cooperating. My supposition as to why they went to her house as well, you know, Robert mentioned she's a lobbyist. Well, she's a lobbyist for the payday lending industry. And she works with Doug Foxley, who is the chief lobbyist for the payday lending industry. And the payday lending industry, of course, has been in the middle of all of this investigations and the money laundering allegations and everything else. It's always centered around the payday lending industry, which both Swallow and Shurtleff, you know, were very close to. And so that's why I think her house was raided. I think they maybe wanted to see what evidence, because Swallow and Shurtleff have had a year and a half to hide any evidence that, you know, or get rid of any evidence that might be in their house. I mean, for them to get a search warrant and raid the homes now seems, you know, kind of questionable because, if they did have anything that was indicate any guilt of anything, I mean, they've had a long time to get rid of it. But so I think that maybe they were looking for any kind of ties or emails or anything that might involve Swallow and Shurtleff at Renee Cowley's house involving the payday lending industry.
Mm-hmm.
If I could, the people I've talked to about this, and I should note that these are not people involved in the investigation, so it may be speculative, but the reasons that they would do that is because they were either looking for information to corroborate other things that she has said or other information they've gathered. Or they've decided that she's not been fully cooperative and that they are looking for additional information that they feel she may have been withholding or lying about. If that's the case, the immunity agreement that her attorney talked about may be void because all of these immunity agreements are all contingent upon, you know, sort of the full cooperation of the witness. And so, you know, she could be looking at an obstruction of justice charge. That, again, that's speculative. We don't know why they served it. We don't know why they served it when they did. But, you know, it is unusual that you have a cooperating witness who's got an immunity agreement and then you go in and serve a search warrant like
right,
that.
Right, right, right. We need to scoot to a break. But before we do, two things that I was surprised by in Shurtleff's comments to us, Robert. He said he was surprised by what he's learning about John Swallow's mm-hmm. activities. And that he has not discussed a plea deal, which both of those find interesting. But I suppose there's still the possibility out there that he is also looking to turn to state's witness and say, you know, this was not me.
Yeah, I think, you know, I think it is possible that if you put enough heat under him, that you could get him to you know, try to negotiate a plea deal. He says he's not done that, and so, you know, I don't have any indication to the contrary. So, and the other piece of it, you're right. I mean, he's kind of been sort of over time going all the way back to sort of January, saying he's sort of January of last year when this thing first broke, he's kind of said he's learning things that he didn't know at the time that he finds very, very disappointing. George may have some feedback from the public on this. Some of the people I've heard from have kind of scoffed at that and said, how could he not know? You know, this guy was your number two guy. He was your campaign, you know, chief campaign fundraiser. But, you know, I guess people sometimes surprise us in life, right?
Well, George? I mean, Mark Shurtleff, if that is the case, Mark Shurtleff is certainly not the first person in the history of elective office who told his underlings, go raise me money and don't tell me how you did it.
Salt Lake Tribune editorial writer George Pyle is with us. Also, Tribune reporter Robert Gerke and columnist Paul Raleigh. You're listening to Behind the Headlines here on KCPW. You can join us as well. We're talking about the week's news. The number 801-355-TALK, 801-355-8255. Send us a tweet to the hashtag TribTalk or put your comments at sltrib.com. We need to take a quick break. We'll be right back. Stay with us. Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce with the Salt Lake Tribune. And joining me in the studio this hour, Tribune editorial writer George Pyle, columnist Paul Raleigh, and reporter Robert Gerke. And you can join us. We're talking about the week's news. And you can send a tweet to the hashtag TribTalk. You can also put your comments at sltrib.com. You can call us. 801-355-TALK is our number. 801-355-8255. A couple headlines caught my eye in the whole gay marriage debate this week. A little movement in one of the cases that's being assessed as a result of the gay marriages that were performed here in Utah during that 17-day window when it was legal. The state of Utah decided to appeal the decision by a federal court judge ordering that the state honor those marriages that were performed here. Yesterday, the 10th Circuit Court of Appeals put that decision on hold. It's another stay. And George, any surprise there?
Well, yeah, they're waiting for this to work its way. I mean, the 10th Circuit hasn't yet ruled on the original case.
Right.
Whichever way it rules is probably going to get appealed to the Supreme Court. So everybody's waiting for that to happen. And we're finding out more and more that the Utah case is maybe key to this whole thing because other states are dropping their cases. Attorneys general in Oregon, California, Virginia are saying, nope, we're done. We got nothing. We can't defend this anymore. Judge issued a ruling, in a federal judge issued the similar ruling in Oregon, saying that Oregon's ban on same-sex marriage was unconstitutional. He didn't stay the ruling, and they went to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court didn't stay the ruling, which they did for Utah. The difference being that in the case of Utah, the state of Utah asked for the ruling to be stayed while the appeals went through the process. In Oregon, the state said, okay, we lose. That's it. That's over. And an independent group, the National Organization for Marriage, they brought the case. They sought the stay. And although the court didn't explain why, which the Supreme Court can do anything it wants, they just say, no, we're not going to issue a stay. They didn't say why. The informed speculation is because it wasn't the state, which is in charge of enforcing laws, that asked. Utah, the state asked, the state got the stay. In Oregon, the state didn't ask, it didn't get the stay. Same-sex marriages are going forward in Oregon. So, you know, the longer there's a legal principle that, you know, the longer something is allowed to go on, the more legal it becomes. And as you have more and more days and more states and more cases where same-sex marriage is the law, it becomes less and less likely that it'll be overturned in any case, especially because all the judges now are ruling in favor of same-sex marriage. Now, if the 10th overturns, that changes everything. What the Supreme Court likes to do is weigh in cases where the 10th Circuit says yes and the 9th Circuit says no and the 7th Circuit says maybe, and we need somebody to resolve this. Right now, among federal judges, there's nothing to resolve. So there's even some speculation as to whether, especially if the 10th Circuit upholds the Utah decision striking Amendment 3, if the 10th Circuit rules against Amendment 3 and is therefore consistent with all the other rulings, and the state asks the Supreme Court to review it, they may not.
Mm. That was a theory that was floated this week by Representative Brian King. The state solicitor general, I believe she is, Bridget Romano, said no, the Supreme Court absolutely is going to weigh in on this. Paul Raleigh, what's your verdict?
Well, if you listen to the rhetoric, then probably the last three or four presidents we've had have appointed nothing but radical activist judges. Because when Judge Shelby ruled in the Utah case, as you'll recall, all the opponents of that ruling, you know, labeled him as an activist judge. Well, now, what is it, 12 judges now? 12, 13 federal judges have done exactly the same thing. So now we've got nothing but radical judges throughout the United States.
And you've got Bush appointees and Obama appointees and Reagan appointees.
All making the same ruling.
Yeah, Bush and Reagan, they appointed nothing but radical judges and activist judges. The other thing, of course, if you listen to the rhetoric, is Oregon now is in a state of anarchy, according to our governor and the other states, because their governors didn't do what he did. So, you know, it's such a political football, and it's becoming silly in my mind. I mean, you know, the federal rulings on these, I mean, they've come with very, you know, thoughtful analyses, you know, by the judges themselves. And now you're hearing all this noise, and you're just hearing name calling and bumper sticker type slogans to argue against what have been very thoughtful decisions backed up by the analysis of the law.
The stay that was issued by the Tenth Circuit is a temporary stay. If they agree with the gay couples, those couples can start applying for spousal benefits, for the adoptions, for the marriage licenses, all that, by next Thursday, June 10th. Robert, did the governor weigh in on this at all this week?
I think you might have stumped me on that one. I'm not sure,
okay.
To be honest. I apologize.
That's okay.
But yeah, I mean, they're going to have to, I would presume at this point that the state agencies have been directed to kind of make preparations and you know, in either event, however this thing goes. And so, yeah, I mean, it's going to be it's going to require a significant shift or significant action by the state and by the governor's office and by the executive agencies.
And what about Utah Attorney General Sean Reyes? I mean, he is the one who asked for the stay. It was granted. What toll are these high-profile cases having on the Reyes administration? Because remember, he's only been in office for 6 months.
This,
I mean, these are coming fast and furious.
This whole thing dropped in his lap, you know, right after he was in office. Even before he was in office, we saw, you know, the initial rulings. I mean, it's taken up a huge amount of time, a huge amount of resources, and we don't know exactly how much money it's taken up yet, but you have to assume that that's going to be a significant amount as well. But, you know, there's both from the governor and from the Reyes administration, we don't see any signs that they're going to let up on this. They're pretty much committed to taking this all the way to the finish and you know, regardless of the cost and the expense and the time involved.
Speaking of gay marriage, we need to move on because there's more news. A group of Mormons supportive of Utah's gay community was denied a permit to march in the state's largest parade, the Days of 47 parade. The Salt Lake City Council said, well, we're not going to boycott, but maybe we'll send a letter to the parade saying you should reconsider. This week, the ACLU jumped into this conversation and said, Council, don't even think about it. Well, was that the right move, George?
Well, if you look at the ACLU's history, I mean, I've talked to some of their lawyers over the years, and they say, look, the ACLU only sues the government. So we only take on what we think is a government violation of somebody's rights. In this case, there's no lawsuit. It's just a matter of the ACLU saying, look, the Days of 47 is a private enterprise run by a church. They can accept or exclude whoever they want.
I don't think they are run by the church.
Isn't it? Well, I mean, but it's not run by the city. It's not a government-run.
No. It's its own standalone entity.
It's its own standalone thing. So it's not a creature of the city or the county or the state. It's not a government agency.
Right.
You know, if a government agency says no, you can't, then you get into all kinds of legal questions. But it's not a government agency. The city council, a government agency, was talking about or did send a letter saying we do not approve, and you know, I think you know. Either way, I mean, they didn't threaten to pull their parade permit. They didn't threaten to stop the parade because they didn't accept the people that they thought they should have accepted. It was just an expression of disapproval on the part of an official government body. And the ACLU was warning them to be careful about how you express your individuals, you can say anything you want. As a government body, as a council, writing on official letterhead, you need to be careful about who you threaten.
How should the city council express its displeasure? Paul Raleigh, I mean, if they're not going to boycott, is there something else that they should be doing?
Well, you know, I'm not so sure it's so bad if they just sent a letter, you know, just expressing their opinion. I mean, I think the city council can express their opinion. George is right, and I agree with the ACLU. I mean, the ACLU is consistent here with the way they always operate, and that is basically, you know, being wary of government trying to tell private, you know, institutions.
So you're okay with a letter on official letterhead going to a private
long as it's not threatening any action or anything. Mm-hmm. If it's just expressing an opinion, I think that I don't see anything wrong with the city council passing a resolution just expressing its opinion. But I think the ACLU is correct that the city council has no business trying to tell the Days of 487 committee who they can have in and who they cannot have in. I think the court of public opinion is more effective here. On this program, we've discussed my column where I talked about past groups that were denied entrance into the Days of 47
sure.
parade, and just the publicity that they got from that caused the Days of 47 and subsequent parades to change their opinion or change their mind. I mean, they didn't let the Clydesdale horses in because they were afraid that it was going to make kids all want to go drink beer, and then I wrote about that. Others wrote about that. And in subsequent years, they were so embarrassed and they got such bad publicity from that that they changed. And they let the Clydesdales in. Same with the Utah Jazz Float 1 year. They thought that the jazz dancers, if they were going to be on the float, were too risque. That made them look really stupid. And they relented on that as well in subsequent years. So I think in this case, in this type of thing, government should not be telling them what to do, but the court of public opinion will eventually weigh in and then they'll make their own decisions mm-hmm. based on that.
Mm-hmm. And just to provide a little context, I mean, the Utah legislature passes dozens of resolutions and sends dozens of these resolutions expressing the legislature's opinion every year. So for the city council to do essentially the same thing on this issue doesn't seem like it's that out of the ordinary. I was actually a little surprised that the ACLU yeah. weighed in the way they did on this particular one.
Hmm. Let's switch gears since our time is fleeting. Let's go to Utah Senior Senator hinting that a seventh term could be in the offing. I was stunned when I read the paper this morning. Robert?
Actually, it'd be his eighth term that he's
eighth
not
term.
Ruling out.
Okay.
Yeah.
Eighth term.
He's certainly not announcing his candidacy. Well, that would be overstating it. But, you know, during his last campaign, during the 2012 campaign, and actually in previous campaigns, there's been one of the big issues that's been used against him is that he's been in office too long. I mean, he came to office in 1976, I believe it was.
76.
Because he beat Frank Moss by saying, you know, what do you call a three-term senator? You call him home. At that point, Frank Moss had been in office way too long. And you know, now he's in his 37th year. He's going to be heading up on 42 years. And he during the campaign, he said over and over again that this was going to be his last run. He was asked about it on a TV interview that aired this week. And he said then that he kind of left the door open a little bit. He said if he's in office, if it's near the end of his term, but he's close to getting tax reform done because that's his top priority, well, in that situation, he might consider, you know, sticking around, sticking around a little longer, I guess. That means he would have to run again. And so that leaves some wiggle room in his previous statements. Now, in fairness, the campaign, his spokesman said his attitude hasn't changed. He's just trying to reaffirm his, you know, express his commitment to getting tax reform done. His campaign machine that, you know, propelled him to a pretty easy victory in 2012 hasn't done much since then. So it's not,
so he's not fundraising.
We're not seeing signs that he's gearing up for another election, but, you know, he's also kind of gone from heck no, I'm not running to, well, you know, maybe, you know, if the situation, the stars align. You know.
I mean, is his statement enough? Is that open door enough to keep other candidates from jumping in? I mean, is that maybe a motivation here? I don't know. George?
Well, I mean, he just got reelected. Senators have six-year terms. But the reason we have what we now call a perpetual campaign, I mean, maybe we've always had it, but we're worried about it now, is because you can't just show up 6 months before an election and say, hey, I think I'd like to be a senator. You have to spend months and years building an organization, raising money, giving some of the money back, raising more money, getting in and out of trouble, and as we've been talking about. And so it's a full-time job all the time. And if there's even a hint in the back of his head that he thinks we might be close to, say, tax reform, and, you know, unicorns and things like that. It's not going to happen. But he has been fighting for this for a long time. I'm sure he sincerely believes, with a lot of people on both sides of the aisle, that the tax system is a mess. It really needs to be reformed. There might be some deals we could cut. You know, Democrats, Republicans, liberals, conservatives could agree on a package of things, and we might get it. And it would be maddening for somebody like Senator Hatch to watch this get closer and closer and closer and closer, and then his term ends, and then either it gets done without him, or worse, because he's gone, it doesn't get done. A new bunch of people come in, and the deal gets dropped, and it doesn't happen. That would be maddening. Mm. So he's got to think, I can't completely close the door because this is my one big thing, and it's like, you know, you don't change horses in the middle of the stream, you don't vote out presidents in the middle of a war. And you stick with it. And yeah, this is the kind of thing that a candidate will say to scare off anybody who might be thinking of running, who might be thinking of giving money to somebody else, who might be thinking of becoming a county chairman for somebody else. And they're going to say, just wait. Let's see what Orrin does.
Or Paul Raleigh, maybe it's his way of saying, I'm not dead yet. I'm not a lame duck yet.
Well, you know, I mean, as the story pointed out, he'll be 84. When it comes time for him to run for his eighth term, and I've always said that makes him old enough to be Strom Thurmond's oldest child. but when Strom Thurmond was still in the Senate, I'm a cynic, and this sort of thing is what brings out my cynicism, maybe more than anything else. I never believe politicians when they say they won't run for another term. You know, I mean, they have to say that at the time, especially when they're getting older and they've been there for a long time. Unfortunately for me, Senator Hatch beat me to it. But I've been contemplating for some time now, writing a column predicting exactly how Senator Hatch will run for his eighth term in 2018, and what I was going to write was there was going to be a committee, or you know, that was going to be formed independent of Orrin Hatch, and it'll be a draft Orrin Hatch to run for an eighth term committee, funded by some PAC whose donations we won't know about because of the Citizens United case, he would say that he'd promised he wasn't going to run again, and he meant it and everything, but he just has to, you know, there's such a demand now for him to run for an eighth term that he just has to do it. You know, Bob Bennett, when he first ran for the Senate, he said, just give me two terms. He said, I'll just serve two terms. Then he ran for a third term, and then he tried to run for a fourth term. And so this is what they all do. You know, I mean, it's like a drug to them. I don't think they can, they just can't give it up.
There's always some exigent circumstances or some emergency or some groundswell of people clamoring for them to run again, and they just can't ignore the, you know, their call to duty. And
can't ignore it. We need to run to another break, but if you are inclined to join us, 801-355-TALK is our number. You're listening to Behind the Headlines here on KCPW. Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce with the Salt Lake Tribune and in-studio columnist Paul Raleigh, editorial writer George Pyle, and reporter Robert Gerke. And you can join us too. 801-355-TALK is our number. You can put your comments at sltrib.com or send us a text, a tweet to the hashtag TribTalk. Underplayed story of the week. Let's do a quick spin through what you think are those underplayed stories. And Robert, what's your pick?
Well, I think the one everybody should take a little bit of time to read is this week we saw the passing of the last Navajo code talker, Chester Nez. Mm. It's sort of the end of an era, one of the great stories in American history, and probably worth, you know, telling your kids about, if nothing else. I also want to, if you indulge me just a minute, a lot of my friends are mourning the passing of Andrea Horsley, who will be missed this week as well.
And
just a friend, a personal friend, and she died this week unexpectedly.
Condolences. George, your pick.
Well, how about the overplayed story of the week?
Overplayed,
over the internet, just completely lit up Twitter. Maureen Dowd had to check out legal marijuana in Colorado. She went and checked into a hotel in Denver and accidentally had 16 times the recommended daily allotment of marijuana-laced chocolate, and wrote about it as only she can. And it's just, you can't go on Twitter or on the internet without reading people. Now imagining what Paul Krugman might do if he mainstreamed Adderall, or what Gail Collins might do if she had some other drug.
The
and
new
people
Gonzo
are
journalism.
Mocking. Right. Yeah, Gonzo journalism is chocolate in a swanky hotel. That's not what Gonzo journalism should be, but maybe that's the pass we've come to.
Did it inspire you to make a trip to our neighbor?
No,
Colorado?
It gives me a headache. I'm sorry. I am just a total dweeb when it comes to that.
All right, that's a good pick. Paul.
I just have to comment on Colorado and her going there, how times have changed. When I was a senior in high school and turned 18, we used to go to drive to Colorado on weekends because you could drink beer at the age of 18, yeah. Back in those days and at Colorado. So Colorado's always been a place of destination for some kind of a thing. But I guess I'll say city of South Jordan trying to get out of the Jordan School District. Are talking about getting out of the Jordan School. I mean, the Jordan School District is—they're just going to die and fade away. Though, you know, first they were the victim of the split. You know, between the two sides, west side and east side of the district, and lost a lot of their tax base. And now the city wants to get out, and I think that it's going to cause a lot of problems. And they're experiencing a lot of problems. They're having a lot of financial problems. Mm. Because they're losing their tax base and they're losing their population.
Well, I had a hard time narrowing it down, you guys, because there were three stories. This week was so chock full of hard news, but there were three stories that caught my eye. One was that Utah still has the highest birth rate in the nation, but mm-hmm. our birth rate has declined like significantly since 2008. Yeah. Kirsten Stewart did a great story on that, so check it out if you haven't read it. The other one. The Latinos at Highland, and you did an editorial on this.
Yes,
George.
We had an editorial about that. They're doing very well.
They're doing great. The graduation rate for Latinos at this Salt Lake City High School is 84%. Mm-hmm. That's higher than the white kids who are in the school, and it's because one guy decided to create this program from mm-hmm. freshman year on up. And really motivate kids, and I just think it's a great, inclusive, hands-on approach to education. I wish we'd see more stories like that. Finally, it's D-Day anniversary today, 70 years. And if you haven't seen Nate Carlisle's really interesting piece on how Utah Beach got its name, check it out.
That's interesting.
Okay, those are my three picks. Paul Raleigh, Robert Gerke, George Pyle of the Salt Lake Tribune. Thank you all very much for your time.
All right, thank you.
Thank you.
And we'll wrap up today's conversation with a discussion with Salt Lake Tribune columnist Robert Kirby, and he freely admits that he is sports impaired.
Oh, yeah, very much so. I've never had an interest in sports in my entire life.
How come?
I don't know. I lack the sports gene, I guess. I found out from a very early age that I didn't have the same interest as other boys, you know. Go around and rattle off the statistics for Don Drysdale or Willie Mays.
You wrote about this impairment, this genetic deficit in a column in 2009. And I guess your son-in-law, you have son-in-laws who are extreme sports fans.
Oh, yeah, they're crazy about sports, all three of them. And they treat me with a certain degree of pity about it. You know, when we have family gatherings, we'll sit around and talk about who's doing what and what the prospects are for this team, most of whom I've never heard of. But one day the Tribune thought it'd be a good idea if they knew about my lack of interest in sports, if I would go to a jazz game with my rabid sons-in-law. And so I did, wrote a column about it. This is from a column I wrote in April of 2009. One in every 500,000 American males suffers from serious sports indifference. It's not something we can help even with season tickets. Rumors that the symptoms can be alleviated with beer are false. The defect in me was apparent from an early age. I tried to hide it by pretending I knew what kids at school were talking about. They howled one day when I offered the opinion that the Boston Celtics might win the World Series. I tried to fit in by joining Little League. I played second string, extreme right field for the Park Lane Lions. My position was in a field of weeds half a mile from the action. one scrawny arm stuffed to the armpit in a mitt the size of a Mexican saddle. The only ball I ever caught was with my head, and that while scrambling to get away from it. Such was my lack of ability that teammates and their parents actually cheered when it happened.
When you have interactions with your rabid son-in-law fans, or even your wife, she's a huge hockey fan.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, how does that work?
I can pretend to know what's going on for about 25 seconds. After that, if it graduates from just the innocuous to something, to a question or a statement with any real meaning, I'm lost.
So I'm guessing that this is a lifelong condition. You don't expect a cure.
No, I don't expect a cure because I'm still not interested in it. I could not care less who wins the World Series. On the other hand, because I've been married almost 40 years to a Canadian rabid hockey fan, I actually know more about hockey than I do any other sport. And it's the only time I've ever heard my wife cuss.
That's Salt Lake Tribune columnist Robert Kirby, and he joins us each week with the best from the archive. You can also find all of his current columns on the website, sltrib.com. That's it for this edition of Behind the Headlines. The show is produced by the Salt Lake Tribune with support from Tyler Ford and Jesse Ellis. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce with the Salt Lake Tribune. Thanks so much for listening. Have a great weekend.